You are listening to an exclusive podcast on Money Control.
Hello and welcome to Money Control Podcast. I'm Santosh Nair and with me is Dhirendra Kumar, founder and chief executive of Value Research, which runs the mutual fund portal valueresearchonline.com. Dhirendra's foray into the world of mutual funds coincided with the opening up of the sector in the early 90s. He's considered to be a pioneer in mutual fund research and analysis. In addition, he also edits two monthly magazines and writes columns on financial planning, capital market policies and market trends. Thanks for joining us on this podcast, Dhirendra.
Thank you, Santosh.
So I'm hoping that at the end of this conversation, our listeners would get to know about your life journey so far as an entrepreneur and investor, understand how the mutual fund industry evolved over the last three odd decades, and they could also get some handy tips on mutual fund investing from the expert himself.
Yeah, that's the core.
So, Dhirendra, tell us what attracted you to mutual funds way back in the 90s. At that time, stocks were the big thing. Harshad Mehta was the rock star of the stock market and share prices were shooting through the roof. In comparison, mutual fund as a product was not very well understood. So, what prompted you to take that path?
No, it was not a very planned thing. I graduated in 1990 and I graduated from a college in Delhi, which was away from the fancy part of Delhi. You know, it was in the village of Delhi. So I had to, you know, spend my time after college. So I went about organizing information. So the newspaper which I used to buy, I used to clip them, organize them. So after my graduation, 3 years of graduation, I was sitting on a dossier of companies and dossier of, you know, things, information which was organized. This was all pre-internet days. You did not have handy information available resulting from a search. Query. So those 3 years of boredom which resulted in those dossiers, they turn out to be wonderful assets. So my starting point was not mutual fund. My starting point was, you know, equity research. I thought, I was curious about equity. I was just trying to figure out how things work, why people, and this was also pre Harshad Mehta, the great Indian scam period. I was curious and there was no information available. I had a lot of questions. And trying to find those answers, you know, and information, there was no CNBC. And there was no internet. So, you know, in those days, all you could do is, you know, try and figure out things, try and read things. I was able to, you know, put those dossiers and was able to put together a piece, which I thought was a little ahead of time. I was able to write a stock report on all the public sector companies, which were likely to go public. The government was thinking of disinvestment. So that was something, you know, that was my early initiative. As a student, I was alone. And that was the start of Value Research in that sense, because the public sector disinvestment was announced. I was still in the college. I just landed up at Economic Times. And those were easy days, pre-terrorism, pre-easy access. I just walked into Swaminathan Iyer's office. It was not very difficult. And he saw my work and said that, why don't we publish it today onward? So he just made me sit in his office and said that, okay, we will carry it as a series. 10 companies disinvestments were announced. So that is how Value Research got started. I had to craft a name then and there, Value Research. It was not a well thought out thing. It was not an incorporated company. It was not even a proprietary firm then. So after I got my check for as compensation for those 10 company reports published in Economic Times, that I went to open a bank account in that name. So that was the start of Value Research, and then that disinvestment happened, and the mutual fund thing was actually a side thing. In 1990, I persuaded my parents to break their fixed deposit and invest in mutual funds.
That was quite adventurous.
That was adventurous, but they thought that, you know, I might be doing something thoughtful, and it was actually, you know, it was great value at that time. Because accessing equity market for individuals was absolutely impossible. You had to be well-heeled. You had brokers never used to attend you. And understandably so. It was a very small market. And the broker was actually taking a lot of risk in terms of the delivery risk, the ability to get the payment or make the payment if you sell something. So mutual fund actually democratized something which was otherwise not accessible to individual investor. So Magnum Multiplier Scheme 1990 was the fourth such equity mutual fund. Equity mutual funds were not big then. And the three that were there, the one which existed before that, one was the Master Share, of course. Then we had the CanShare, and then we had another one from Canara Bank, which was, you know, it was not, so CanShare, and there was another one. And then this MMS 90. So I persuaded my parents to invest in this mutual fund.
If I may ask, how much did you ask them to part with?
They parked quite a bit of their savings, because my parents were, you know, they're government servants. My mom is a teacher. My father was, you know, a central government officer. So, you know, all their savings was in deposits. And so I was able to, you know, persuade them to invest few lakh rupees. And that was quite a remarkable thing, because few lakh rupees in those times was quite a bit.
Indeed.
Because we are talking of, you know, 30 years ago. That apart, the money actually turned 18 times in flat 18 months.
Wow.
So this 10 rupee invested became 180 rupee. Because, and thanks to that, you know, the Great Indian Scam, the absolute unawareness about it. And this is when my mutual fund thing came in, because all I, you know, I was a believer of, you know, fact-led thinking. And so all I did was, you know, put together a scorecard of all mutual fund. First, I, you know, there were about 80 funds there, of which only 7-8 were equity funds, remaining were hybrids and fixed income. And I was able to put together the name of them, and they were all closed-end funds. So the basic features, when they started, when they will expire, their maturity date, what are the terms of maturity, any interim liquidity that will be enabled by the fund company, because there used to be partial repurchase possible for, you know, something like master gain and things like that. There will be start of a repurchase, and they were all listed. You could buy them at a steep discount or big premium. So these funds, and get their NAV. The disclosure of mutual fund information at that point was absolutely, you know, ridiculous. We used to get the NAV of a mutual fund every quarter, and that too with a 2-month lag, and that also was supposed to get published in some hidden newspaper in some back page. So, you know, most of the time it will be appearing in, you know, Afternoon Dispatch and Courier or something like that. The cheapest newspaper advertising will be bought by fund companies to do that statutory publishing of those NAVs. So that was very interesting. I had a piece of information which others didn't have, and putting it all together, I was able to make a whole story. I was able to understand that all these funds are trading at 10 times, 20 times, because the Magna Multiplier scheme, which I was telling you, which was trading at 18 times, you know, which multiplied 18 times, the NAV of that was about 20 rupees. And in 1992 May, it was trading at 180 rupees in the market.
Quite a big jump.
A big premium to its NAV. It was selling at 9 times its real worth. And that was the time when I had, you know, started reading Peter Lynch and Warren Buffett and the Berkshire Hathaway's, you know, annual reports, which will get published here and there. Being in Delhi was little advantageous, because we had the American Central Library, we had the British Council Library, and that was, you know, half an hour bus ride from my place. So we had access to wonderful, you know, knowledge repository, where we could see how things are done elsewhere, because there was a huge information gap. So that was it. And once I did this, I persuaded my parents to sell those investments. That 3 lakh becoming 18 times was quite a... That was actually... One is that you look at it in terms of return on investment. But I decoded something else. What I decoded was that money gives you freedom. And I saw it happening live. I saw it happening first time. You know, that before that I was, you know, undergoing my education. I never understood what, you know, it looked like a game. It is not a game. It causes a difference to the way you think, your plans, your life plans, gives you freedom, gives you choice. I saw that happening in my parents' life, that, you know, my father had planned that he'll retire and build his house. That is how it used to happen those days. He was able to prepone that plan. His plans about my sister's wedding underwent a change in terms of being little liberal or being little more exploratory and things like that. So I saw those, you know, not life impacting, but suddenly very impactful changes. had it been, you know, it can happen, it can mean different things to different people at different stages, but it was just not a game. The mutual fund turned out to be, at that point, it was a state of infancy. They were getting started. And I thought that this is something which looks very promising. It is accessible to anybody. It is simple. And it has the potential. And it is making something accessible, which is otherwise not accessible, desirable to have. So that was the, so I was able to put together a scorecard of mutual fund. Went back to Swaminathan here again. And he was a ready buyer. He was a ready, you know, he just that piece of work as well started getting published from that day onward. So my mutual fund scorecard appeared in what is now discontinued Investor's Guide of Economic Times, which used to get published every Monday. It continued for the next decade. And that was the start of value research. That was the that was my brush with mutual fund, personal experience, the commercial experience, and the start of the scorecard. And for next 5 years, it carried on.
So as soon as you were out of college, you were already in business.
I got into business, and you know, it was not a planned implementation of a business plan. It just happened.
So what were the initial days like? What do you recall of it? Some bittersweet moments?
Oh, they are all sweet. No bitter. Because now with hindsight, I can tell you that it was sometimes, you know, a lot of people used to take, they used to look at me as, you know, the liability in terms of somebody who has turned up to seek the information. I will ask for the net asset values of from fund companies. There were 8 companies then, 5 bank sponsored. One LIC, one GIC, and UTI, and 5 banks sponsored the Can Bank, the State Bank, SBI Mutual. Then you had the Bank of India, Bank of Baroda, and Indian Bank. 8 of them. When I'll turn up at the, in these places to ask for the NAV, because there you can ask for the NAV before that, because they used to publish it in the newspapers with a lag, and I was supposed to, you know, I was trying to deliver. The most recent information available. So you will be made to wait and things like that. At one point, there was a very interesting incident. I went there at a fund company to ask for the NAV, and they said that we haven't calculated it. Why don't you help us do that? You know, so they gave me the ledger that, you know, multiply the number of shares with current. You know, there used to be a printed bhav copy. So I was made to tabulate the, you know, write down the prices of closing prices of stocks from the bhav copy into that ledger so that, you know, the multiplication gets easier. So I contributed a little bit to the calculation of the NAV at a couple of fund companies. But mostly, you know, I immediately after, you know, the scorecard became popular, I was generally welcomed, and I was quite a, you know, I would not say pampered, but surely acceptable evil, because I was just putting, you know, everything in the public domain and bringing greater transparency. And I saw there was, you know, there were other things. The mutual fund, which used to trade at huge premium to NAV around the Great Indian Scam in 1992, soon after publication of this scorecard, the premium disappeared. They started trading at discount. And then I saw the birth and the emergence of the modern mutual fund, because what I'm telling you is pre-SEBI days. SEBI mutual fund regulations became effective in 1993, which also allowed, you know, which coincided with the, you know, emergence of the private sector. So we saw the Kothari Pioneer and the Morgan Stanley's making an entry. So witnessing that, the start of the open-end fund, the disbelief in the start of open-end mutual fund, Kothari Pioneers, you know, initial focus on creating awareness that you will not get a mutual fund certificate, but you'll get an account statement from here on, persuading fund companies to share their portfolios with us. That's a very interesting story. I went to UTI to seek that, and I was told that it is a secret information and they're not supposed to disclose it. And rightly so, there was no law, you know, if quarterly NAV was this disclosure norm. So what happened was, you know, I was told no. And then I actually through a carrot that if you share your portfolio, then I'll be able to write about it and you'll benefit as a result of it. And without information, what do I say about MasterShare? So, but you know, it did not work. So I came back and I was able to derive the, you know, the portfolio of UTI from Parliament Library. And being in Delhi was quite advantageous. And so getting the portfolio, because it was, you know, set up under the parliamentary statute, and, you know, they had to do their annual filing, and UTI's annual report was filed in the parliament every year. So that was my first, you know, discovery that if information is there in the public domain and you create awareness and anything which is based on facts, then you know, making your point across gets easy. I was not giving anything out of my hat. It was not a random thing. It was based on facts, publicly disclosed information. So that was the start of, you know, many interesting story, because, you know, for first 10 years I was hands-on. I was doing everything. I used to input the NAVs. I used to design the scorecard. I used to deliver the scorecard at Economic Times at midnight every Friday. So it was interesting. It was, you know, doing everything yourself and the learning on the curve in the process. So it was very interesting.
So what are the basic rules that you followed in running your business, and how have they evolved over the years?
No, there are two basic rules which I follow. One is that produce something which is useful.
Okay.
And the other is even more straightforward. Make more money than you spend. So, and if you have these two things in place, big or small, because, you know, the definition of big or small, but, you know, it creates enough. And that does the job.
And you've stuck to that all throughout. No additional rules.
I didn't have the margin of error. If I was ever spending more than I earned, I will pack and go back home. I remember my early 3-4 years that, you know, I always coming from a conservative, traditional family where, you know, you get up in the morning, take a bath, and, you know, light a agarbatti in front of a god. So we used to have, I used to have, you know, I carried on, carried on to my room as well, where, you know, the place where I used to stay alone in Delhi. So I used to have a Bhagavad Gita there. So I'll have my emergency money, which was a 100 rupee note, which is everything goes wrong, you buy the ticket, go back home. So you don't have I didn't have the margin of error. So that second thing was non-negotiable. And first thing was that I did not come from any background which will get me any privilege. I did not have access. I was not networked. I was not, you know, I had no advantage. So unless you had a belief that if you produce something useful, there was absolutely no choice. So that, I think, has carried on.
And how has your style of management changed? So over the first 10 years, you said that you were pretty hands-on. And after that?
First 10 years, I'm even now hands-on. Okay. I know everything that goes on. And also that I have done each and every role. I've done the sales job. I've done the data acquisitions job. I've written stories. I've written columns. I've written reports. I learned about, you know, I was always a vendor to other publications. I started writing a column for Business Today in 1993. I was always producing that scorecard for Economic Times, so I understood the deadline, the need for accuracy. So many of those values, you know, and those values were not, it was not determined by the policy of the respective companies. They were my personal values which evolved that you will be out of business if you are not right. So your margin of error is very wrong, is very small if you are a vendor. Nobody is going to, you know, excuse you for a mistake. So I was extremely careful. So that rigor of work to be done came because of that. It was entirely out of fear that it will be embarrassing. Besides, you will be out of business. You'll be unemployed and you'll starve to death. So so that was the primary driver. But that part, you know, so I we do at Value Research everything. Then the television thing happened, then the internet happened. So, you know, there is a story at the start of every business. It was not a planned thing. You know, we started our Value Research Online, which was once again not an implementation of a plan. Just that in 1999, a lot of internet companies came. They all wanted to start a mutual fund website yesterday. And they were big companies, GE Capital, Go4i, which was a Hindustan Times company, including Money Control, which was not Money Control because Money Control was acquired by TV18. So everybody was my customer for information. And we had 50 such companies, more than 50 such companies, which came into being. And in a matter of, you know, 1.5 years, they all disappeared. We were lucky to get the money and a lot of customers. I built a capacity to serve those customers with our technology organization, which was built from scratch. And that was the time when we hurriedly, because before that, Value Research database was a long list of, you know, a large number of Excel files because data wasn't much. And I was in the know of each and every piece of data because I was so hands-on. I still remember most of the starting date and end date and terms of the mutual fund schemes. So, and we formulated the classification system, which has now evolved into the SEBI's classification system. So, because the initial classification system was, you know, closed-end funds, hybrids, open for repurchase. So, you know, that classification system was not the objective-driven classification system. So, this is what happened in 1999. The start of Value Research Online was entirely an accident because I had to deploy those people who had built the capacity to handle that data, and Value Research came into being and all others died. You know, we only have 4 companies which have existed since then of our customers. You know, ICICI Direct or EconomicTimes.com or, you know, Money Control.
Okay, so retaining talent is the key to the success of any business doing well. What's been your experience on this front?
Yes, retaining talent is a challenge. And for first 10 years, I had no plans of retaining the talent because I just couldn't. We didn't have margin. We were making a living. And so first 8-10 years, we had a lot of people who came, learned and went away to run great businesses, do meaningful things, because their financial aspirations was not met or could not be met because the whole business was evolving. There was no business plan and there was no capital. There was no margin of, you know, you can't really build things to sustain them. I think since 1999, I was able to build enough resources so that I can plan medium term and long term. Because before that, it was living on a day-to-day basis. Whatever margins, whatever surplus we will create, some of the assets will actually guzzle it. You needed a 600 DPI printer, which will cost you 85,000 rupees, which was important for, you know, or you need a scanner. So, you know, just to give you a perspective of, you know, how cost changed, my first 286 costed about, you know, 80,000 rupees in 1990, which was a big capital investment. And a Maruti car, Maruti 800, will cost you 45,000 rupees then. So you had to make a choice whether you want to have a car or a 286, you know, which was, and my first computer was a 286 40 MB with 4 MB RAM, which was priced at this much. Or likewise, you know, getting a fax machine, which was the primary source of getting information from fund companies. Otherwise you actually tied up with a STD PCO center to get your, you know, you gave that number for getting those faxes. So it was fun, but, you know, trying to prioritize these things, the capital guzzling nature of, you know, sourcing information, essential stuff, we didn't have the margin. So 2000 onward, you know, I had enough resources to think medium term, long term, not to live on a day-to-day basis. And after that, you know, it's, there are two set of people I come across. The people who are able to enjoy what they're doing here. And then there are people who look at it as a job. So you get focused on the people who enjoy. And I have, you know, many employees. In fact, of my current strength, the people who have been with me for 10 years, I don't think they even think in terms of, you know, they just like me and we like them.
Okay. Magazine is a very tough business to be in. Very few of them in India make meaningful profits, if at all. So what prompted you to get into that space?
Same principle. But magazines in India is unprofitable. I think it is other magazines' problem. We have always been profitable. And the two principles, which I stated earlier, that you have to be useful and you have to make more money than you spend. This actually was a very significant thing in our life. 2002 October, market was down in the dumps. Market was at 2800 on the Sensex. And I created this, you know, I devised this magazine. I thought that it'd be a useful thing. Initially, you know, we used to produce something at Value Research, which was called Mutual Fund Performance Report. Mutual Fund Performance Report was priced at, it was packaged as a research product. It was a set of performance tables, portfolio aggregates and other things. And it was priced at something like 30,000 rupees. And we had 15 subscribers. Of the 25 companies which existed then, 15 of the 25 companies used to subscribe. Even companies used to find it difficult to subscribe. And so I thought that this is a very useful thing. People are able to get a comparative statistics on mutual fund performance, which can guide them make a choice. And it was priced at a level where, you know, it cannot be democratized. So I thought of, you know, packaging it in a manner whereby, because consumers won't pay 18,000 rupees, 30,000 rupees for a research product, which will have a daily update, a weekly update by email, or, you know, a printed version of a 100-page document, and it was useful for almost every investor or every intermediary at least. So I thought of devising a mechanism of getting that across to people, to intermediaries and investors, or, you know, geeks, mutual fund geeks, and getting the price point to 100 rupee. So 100 rupee, I was making money on the cover price. It used to cost about 35, 38 rupees to produce the magazine. 20, 30 rupees as the distributor's commission. IBH India Bookhouse was our distributor. So we used to still make 10, 20 rupees. And I thought that, you know, because it is going to be an opinionated product on mutual fund, if you have too much advertising, we run the risk of, you know, not being looked at as independent. And the magazine just took off. We had ready advertisers. Every fund company wanted to advertise. Every fund company wanted to take the back cover. And most fund companies wanted to underwrite that they would like to advertise for years. And when we launched the magazine, all I did was wrote a mail to 30,000 distributors that this magazine has been launched. It might be useful to you. And I wrote it to, you know, all the people who used to write postcards to Value Research seeking some information. So that was our only marketing spend. Writing letters to people who were connected to us. All the business card collected over period in public engagements and other places. And we were able to get 10,000 subscribers in few months. And that was it. Of course, by that time, Value Research Online was also live. So we could really see the response. You know, we were the first website, first magazine to be a believer of subscription. And our first issue onward, we had live subscription available. You know, you could subscribe online. And I enabled that and we got ready subscribers. So this is a very unique magazine. Other magazines, maybe they have to ask both the questions again, that are they useful? And in the changing context, because I find that, you know, even we have to reinvent ourselves. I really wonder that, you know, my magazine has the same important role as it played back then in 2003, because in 2003, internet was not that democratized. Reliance Jio wasn't there. You always needed a computer to access that information. Now that is available on the phone. So my magazine, for the information, for the data, it may not be that relevant. So we have to change ourselves, and we have changed ourselves in a limited way. But I think, you know, magazines will lose relevance, but simply because it turns out to be a ready reckoner. All the people who love mutual fund or who like mutual fund, or they are involved with mutual fund where they make a living, they carry it in their briefcase till the next month's issue replaces it. So it's simply useful. So we have, you know, nearly about 95% renewal rate and we have never seen a decline over this period.
So how do you manage your investments? Do you put all your money into mutual funds?
Yes, I put all my money. I used to put all my money in mutual fund. Last 1 year, I have, you know, started putting some money in stocks directly. We launched a service called Value Research Stock Advisor. And a lot of our subscribers started complaining that here is Dhirendra Kumar, who is running a stock advisory service, and he doesn't want to, and he has no investment in stocks. So I have deep-rooted interest in stock. It's just that, you know, I don't see mutual fund and stocks, investing in stocks directly, as any conflicting thing. My primary thing is that my long-term money should be in equity. And I would say that if you have the time, if you have the inclination, if you enjoy doing it, you should be investing in stocks, because besides the return, besides investing in equity, the joy of discovering great stock, finding great companies, because it's not the joy of discovering the great companies. In the process, you learn all about the crooked companies, all the rejections, because for all the stock that we recommend, and there'll be about 15 to 20 stocks which we don't, but we learn in the process. So that became interesting. But it was, so I've decided that over the next 4 years, I'll be moving 50% of my net worth into stocks, but in a fairly methodical way. And my strategy on stock will, you know, all my portfolio is a public disclosure on my website.
So what do you look for when deciding on which mutual fund to invest in?
Which mutual fund to invest? Initially, we didn't have a choice. But one is that, you know, I've, going by what has happened to my money in mutual fund in the last 25 years, if you invest in an equity fund and if you forget about it, 20-25 years, it works out nicely anyway. And I actually find it very amusing that we did not have a choice of which fund to invest in way back in 91, 92, 93 or 94, 95, whole of 90s. And in those days, there used to be a section called Section 88, which is the predecessor section of Section 80C. The maximum investment that was possible was 10,000 rupees in a mutual fund. And that was off the 60,000 which was available under Section 88. So I invested 10,000 rupees in the tax saving funds. Some of those investments are up 20 times, 30 times, sometimes 40 times. And those are investments which is pre-PAN days, which is pre-email days. So simply because, you know, they are not available online accessible. So they are valid investments, and they have just turned out to be blockbusters. Simply, you need time, and you need to be invested in equity, and you need to be entrusting that money to a reasonable fund manager. And if you are able to do your SIP, nothing like it, you'll be able to average better, which was not a possibility in the closed-end era. So that's basic. Long-term money, investing in equity regularly, that takes care. But that apart, if you have to choose the fund managers, I would say that, you know, look at a fund with a five-year history, a fund which has been through at least one down cycle and up cycle, and a fund which has done little better than others in a down cycle and little less worse than others in a down cycle and up cycle. That's good enough, because it's hard to predict which one will do best. But if a fund manager has demonstrated this in a full market cycle, you have hope.
So if one is looking to build a portfolio of mutual fund schemes, what is an optimal number of schemes that he should be investing in?
It means different thing for different people. You can build a great portfolio with just one fund if you have 5,000 rupees to invest. One balanced fund and it does it all. Look at the benefits. You are investing in equity. It will have embedded rebalancing. You will not be liable for any taxes till you realize that money. You will be able to do it convenience. You can make 500 rupee investment and you can increase it by 10% every year. And your 75% money can be in equity, 25% in fixed income, and all the money will be treated as equity investment. So look at the multiple advantages. And nowadays, if you are little thoughtful, if you are investing in the direct plan, it will come with a very low cost, because now from 1st April, the cost of mutual funds is going to be, you know, streamlined more. So you just might get it at, you know, about 1% or less than 1%. And as it gets bigger, it will cost you even lower. So it could be one fund. It could be more than one fund if you want to spread your risk. But I would say that for most people, one fund to five fund will fulfill most of your needs, very complex investment needs. Because all you need is at best two or three multi-cap funds, one tax saving fund for sake of getting, you know, that 150,000 rupee which is your entitlement. You can consider that fund also as your multi-cap allocation, and that takes care of it. That apart, one liquid fund for any money which you want it to be on call, and any medium term need, you know, money which you are likely to need anywhere between 1 to 4 years, and you don't want to take chances with that. For example, if your child is getting into college and you want to move a part of your equity money into fixed income so that you are sure of, you know, not struggling with that money, but not taking any chance with that money, the first year college fee and admission fee, that money should be an ultra short term bond fund or a short term bond fund. So 3 to 5 funds can fulfill most people's need.
And should investors book profits in their mutual fund investments from time to time? What should the approach be?
It should primarily, you know, two reasons when you should book your profit. One is that fund has turned bad. If you thought of that, you have chosen a good fund and it is not proving to be one, by all means, book profit and move that money, invest in some better fund immediately. And the other is need based. When you need the money, you need the money. And so just take it out. And it's important that how you take the money out from any market linked investment, because that is something everybody has been told about, do SIP. Nobody has told you that how to take your money out, how long before you need it. So you do your SIP to reduce the risk of catching a market high, even if you have lump sum money. You are definitely going to need a lump sum money when you need it, if you are planning for a goal. And make sure that you are not dependent on the madness of the market for your such critical needs. So do your systematic withdrawal plan. Withdraw your money methodically well before you need it, because if you are going to depend on the market, markets can be crazy on occasion, and it is very likely to be crazy entirely when you need it, going by the Moore's law. So, you know, just be a little thoughtful and methodical about averaging things.
So how much time do you devote to reading? What are the kind of books that you read, and could you name some books that left a lasting impression on you?
Of course, the first investment book which I read, which still I think is a must read, and you know, must read for every people. Most analysts who join Value Research, I encourage them, sometimes I buy it for them, One Up on the Wall Street. It's a easy read. It helps you comprehend things. It's a nice story being told, which helps you comprehend about, you know, basics of fundamental investing, what works in investing or in stocks. Then most of my reading is actually, of course, I've read all the investment books and all the informational stuff. But that is more of a need to read, because one writes column and one is looking for interesting ideas and opportunity. Beyond that, I think, you know, very unrelated things, things on psychology, or this is one book which I discovered after 15 years of running Value Research, which is Up the Organization by Robert Townsend. I wish, you know, when I was getting started in 1990, I would have read this. This is one book which I keep it on my desk, and which I also, you know, buy a copy of this for all the line managers, because this is a guideline. It is a one-page guideline on anything that you do in the business: how to conduct meetings, how to organize party, how to hire, how to advertise, how to write copies. I like this. I wish I had, and this is a very direct, you know, it very much aligns with my line of thinking, that useful, profitable, and direct and straightforward. But then there is a lot more to learn. Of late, you know, I've been reading a lot on something like, you know, the Basecamp founder's book, 37 Signals, or, you know, things like that. And what I enjoy reading of late, for a couple of years now, is history. I'm taking a history of varied kind.
And have you been teaching your children how to manage their finances? Do you discuss your work with them?
I discuss my work with them, but they have their own interest. And I have two daughters. The younger one seems a little more interesting and more interested. And but what I find is that, you know, something, you know, it's hard to teach them. It's hard to tell them. It's hard to sit in a session where you start teaching them. But I think they see you, they observe you. They learn things not while you're teaching, but the way you are conducting yourself, how we make our buying decision, what we spend on, how we think when we are buying something, how much hard we think before we do things. So I think they figure out. That I think is a good lesson. That apart, they are still not extravagant. So that is coming in handy.
Thank you for taking time out for us, Dhirendra. It was an interesting conversation, and I'm sure our listeners would have gained some useful insights on investing as well as entrepreneurship.
Thank you for this opportunity, Santosh.
This has been a Money Control presentation.